from the Sky News Centre at 6. Prince Harry and his brother William are enjoying a walkabout in Windsor, meeting some of the crowds of people gathered for the royal wedding. The brothers have been having photos with fans, chatting to children and shaking people's hands. We also now know Prince Charles will walk Meghan Markle down the aisle tomorrow. That's gone down well with these royal fans in Windsor.
I think it will be absolutely magical on the day, seeing them walk down the aisle. It would just be really emotional, and I think he's been a real gentleman.
That's absolutely amazing. Brilliant. To me, that's the right choice.
Final preparations are being made ahead of the couple's big day tomorrow. Also this afternoon, a number of people have been killed in a shooting at a high school in the US state of Texas. Police in Santa Fe believe fewer than 10 have died. One person's in custody and one is of interest. Both are believed to be pupils. An officer was also shot and injured, and explosives have been found. Donald Trump spoken of his sadness.
We grieve for the terrible loss of life and send our support and love to everyone affected by this absolutely horrific attack.
The former Russian spy poisoned in Salisbury more than 2 months ago has now been discharged from hospital. Scotland Yard has refused to explain what security arrangements it has in place for Sergei Skripal, though. Another 88,000 BMW cars have been recalled due to an electrical fault that can cause the engine to cut out. It's affected 390,000 certain 1 and 3 series, Z4 and X1 models. And in sport, relegated West Brom have appointed Darren Moore as their permanent head coach, while other Premier League clubs heading for the Championship, Swansea and Stoke, are both looking for new managers. That's the latest from the Sky News Centre. I'm Annie Joyce.
Pat and I take you on a scrumptious spice journey with succulent chicken and vegetable tapas dishes.
This is Bristol. It's Friday, 6 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's May 2018 9/11 Truth Special. I'm Tony Gosling. As the rest of the corporate media waste millions of hours of airtime and millions of column inches on a criminal elite wedding in Berkshire this weekend, we take a look at how the super rich elite here in the West plan to hold on to their power into the 21st century and the age of the internet through war and lies, killing their own people, dumbing the rest of us down through controlling mainstream media narrative. Tonight, the attack on New York and Washington on 11th of September 2001 is in danger of turning this 21st century into a century of perpetual war, normalising the policy of regime change, targeting a country's resources and government, then cooking up any old excuse to invade, including faking TV footage or even killing your domestic population, then to blame the attacks on the country you want to invade, the so-called false flag attack. NATO's Anglo-Zionist Empire has been sending special forces into Syria and Iran to train terrorists, violating international law. Where it's politically difficult, we just hire Blackwater, or whoever they are, whatever they're called these days, or their friends, to do it on contract with deniability. So we'll be hearing tonight from our studio experts, author of 9/11 The New Evidence, Ian Henschel, an Oxford-based retired engineer and author of a new report on the collapse of World Trade Center Building 7, Dave Barmby. Also from airline stewardess Rebecca Roth, who was so incensed with the 9/11 lies, she did her own investigation, which she produced as a book called Methodical Illusion. And before Hollywood director and candidate for governor for Arizona, Aaron Russo, died of cancer 10 years ago, he spilt the beans on secret conversations between himself and banker Nick Rockefeller, who told him in the 1990s about elite plans for the world, including a 9/11 style event leading to the invasion of Afghanistan many years before it actually happened. Plus, finally, on the Israeli connection, Jewish former head of studies at the US Army War College, Alan Sobrowski, who believes the Israeli mafia control many key US institutions, including the Congress. That's all in the second hour and the first hour this week after 6 o'clock. But first hour, two weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, dry and low, temperatures around 12 degrees Celsius. This weekend, warm and sunny, very little cloud, around 20 Celsius. Very nice for the event in Berkshire, which we will not be mentioning. Next week, it's dipping, temperatures dipping midweek. Cloud to cover and rain, a couple of minor showers is all we're going to be getting next week, and generally quite sunny. Next weekend, there's the 26th and 27th of May. Sunny again, but a little cooler, 15 to 18 Celsius. Sunny week, clouding over a bit at the end of the next weekend. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So joining me in the studio now, say hello to everybody, is Ian Henshaw, author of 9/11, The New Evidence. Hi, Ian. Welcome
hello.
Back.
Hello.
Also, Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers.
Hello.
And Dave Barmby. I think what we'll do is we'll start with you, Ian Henshaw. What inspired you to write the book, 9/11, The New Evidence?
Well, just nobody else had, and it needed doing, and I had a mainstream publisher who was prepared to publish it, which was, you know, quite unusual for a 9/11 issue. And actually, without wanting to boast too much, my book is still in print 10 years later, and people who know much about books all know that that's, you know, of sorts an achievement. I still get royalty payments for it. But the sad reason, of course, is that the mainstream hasn't really published anything since that's taken it any further. It's always surprising, though, to look back 10 years and see, you know, without wanting to sound conceited, how accurate my book was about the issues. Because, of course, we've got two different sets of issues, really, with 9/11. We've got what you might call the paper trail, you know, such as how did these alleged hijackers get onto the planes when the CIA knew all about them? And then you've got the what I would call the physical evidence, such as how come it looks very much as if the World Trade Center was exploding rather than collapsing with pieces hurled out at high speed. But my speciality, I guess, is the paper trail. And of course, there has been some rather amazing developments in the last year or two in the American courts. We've got two parallel actions going now in the American courts. One is seeking to blame the Saudis for the 9/11 attacks, and of course there's a great deal of evidence to support that, at least on the surface. And the other is now, recently, very exciting, trying to get discovery of all the evidence on how the Twin Towers collapsed, which of course has been kept secret. Even the blueprints of the buildings have still been kept secret all these years afterwards. But due to a rather amazing event in the American Congress 2 years ago, the courts are now prepared to investigate this issue.
Joined in the studio by Dave Barmby, who's just brought out his own report into the collapse of World Trade Center Building 7. But before we hear from Dave, Ian, why is World Trade Center 7 so significant?
Well, because it wasn't hit by a plane, basically. I mean, the official story in a nutshell, in a soundbite, which is, of course, all you ever hear about the official story nowadays, the official story says the buildings collapsed because they were hit by planes. And that is taken to explain everything. For instance, explaining the fact that the firefighters were so sure the buildings wouldn't collapse that they set up a headquarters on something like the 60th floor, which, of course, led to 300 firefighters dying. Experts didn't think it would collapse. Nobody did. So, but the explanation given is that planes hit the buildings. But, of course, World Trade Center 7 was not hit by a plane. The most it was hit by was a bit of falling debris from one of the other World Trade Centers. So here you have a one-off event in the history of architecture and engineering, the collapse of a steel frame building that was not hit by a plane. There were fires, but fires don't bring down steel frame buildings. It needs much higher temperatures than that.
Over to you, Dave. What was it that made you think that you had any sort of expertise to look at what happened at World Trade Center Building 7?
I'm an engineer, and any self-respecting engineer ought to be able to study what I've studied and produce a short booklet like I've done in the last couple of months. I'm quite new to this subject, and I think I'm like everyone else on 9/11.
What prompted you to write it, though? Just tell
me. Well, that's what I'm just going to explain. I mean, Ian has taken some of my thunder away by talking
about
WT7. But Going back to 9/11.
Okay, so let's just get to cut to the chase. What was it about what you saw happened at Building 7 that made you think that there was it was needed for someone with your engineering expertise to go into it and have a better look?
Well, I didn't think about it very much until a couple of months ago, because I looked at the architects and engineers' analyses on the internet, and there's loads of that. And they were coming to the conclusion, or showing, that it was a controlled demolition. They didn't seem to do very much on criticising the NIST report. NIST, by the way, is the National Institution for Standards and Technology, who were tasked with looking into this work. So it was only 2 months ago when I was invited to go to talk to Professor Bailey, the inaugural lecturer at Queen Mary College London, that I was thought his lecture was so naff and missing the point. So I there and then got almost angry, and I decided to start looking at it in detail. So, having got a recording of his talk, I then went through it bit by bit, and essentially pulled it apart, which is what I'm going to talk about as we go into this.
Let's just have a look at NIST. How did they get involved in the collapse?
Well, NIST weren't initially involved. Initially, it was
The National Institute for Science and Technology. Is that it?
That's right. Standards
and Technology.
Now, what happened, Tony, is that initially the Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA, were tasked with looking at it straight away after almost immediately after the event on the 11th of September 2001, and. And they spent a year looking at it, and it was generally thought that FEMA weren't coming up with the right story. They were missing the point as far as the politicians were concerned. And so the National Institute for Standards and Technology were brought in to look at it, and it's quite strange, really, because I think they were quite bemused themselves at having to.
Okay, so what's wrong with NIST's findings?
Well, I was going to come to that. I wanted to talk about the problem that NIST had in the first place to look at it. Okay? So NIST had an awful job, because they were sort of undermined by. President Bush on the first couple of days, when he talked about the when he announced the war on terror, I think it was five days after the event. So having announced that it was a terror attack, and that we're going to declare war on the terrorists, there was not much less that NIST could look at. They couldn't look at the possibility of control demolition.
They weren't interested in the political side of it, were they? Surely they were just looking at the collapse and what caused it.
Well, they obviously had terms of reference, and they didn't have much to go on, really, because that building came down, WTC 7, in six and a half seconds, which is almost free fall.
Okay, so NIST said what exactly?
Well, NIST came to the conclusion, the only thing they could pin their hat on was fires in the building. So they say it was fires in the building, office furniture fires, which heated up the steelwork, the columns and the beams and the girders, and caused a beam to fall off the girder, setting in motion a collapse, what they call horizontal progressive collapse, which is a new term that came out of that time to explain
what
happened.
Now, let's see if we can bring in Richard Gage from Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. Richard, can you hear me?
sure can. Hi, guys.
Yeah, so could you give us your assessment of NIST and how reliable their initial report was?
NIST, the National Institute of Standards and Technology, was tasked by Congress to explain the collapses of all three towers. And all they are able to come up with is that because of these fires, as the gentleman mentioned, we have all of a sudden, because of thermal expansion, pushing of long span beams, pushing a girder off of its seat on this particular column number 79 in the northeast section, caused the 13th floor to fall, the 12th, and so on for 9 floors, allowing column 79 to be unbraced for 9 floors, and that caused the complete failure vertically through that section of building from top to bottom, 47 stories, and then this instability travels laterally across this football field-length building in about 10 seconds, and then we see the overall building coming down, and none of that makes sense, but especially when you look at the building, it falls completely from top to bottom in under seconds, symmetrically at free fall acceleration, as fast as a bowling ball falling off the building. So that makes no sense because, that means 40,000 tons of structural steel did not provide any resistance for at least a third of this building's fall. And so where did it go? I mean, it was 3 to 5 times stronger than it needed to be to support this building, and all of a sudden, it's not there at all. The building doesn't fall in stages and allow time for columns to buckle and break. No, it falls suddenly, smoothly, symmetrically, just like the old controlled demolitions, like for us in the U.S., the old hotels in Las Vegas, but you have controlled demolitions here in the U.K. as well. So since it looks exactly like a controlled demolition, NIST should have seriously considered controlled demolition right up front among their first hypotheses as to how this building came down, rather than relegate it to a series of frequently asked questions and the answers to those a year later on their website.
Richard, what is it that you think happened then? If the NIST report is not correct, what happened at World Trade Center Building 7?
Well, it's very clear what happened, because just by watching it, you can see that it looks exactly like a controlled demolition. The videos completely betray the NIST theory of initiation of collapse. What they show is that all of the supports had to have been taken out down low in the building, at least 8 stories simultaneously. All 82 columns in this building had to have been removed within a fraction of a second of each other. This can only be done by explosive controlled demolition. And that is exactly how they do it. And as a matter of fact, we have lots of evidence of just that in the aftermath of this building's collapse.
Dave, can I just ask you, with your report that you've done, and you produced it and you put it out there for peer review, what are the implications of the things you've found, you yourself, in this report that you've done?
Well, I think the implications are the same as Richard Gage's just stated. I've gone into some of the aspects in a bit more detail. I've only concentrated on WTC7. Richard mentions the free fall for the first 100 feet, that's about 5 or 6 stories. There was nothing supporting the floors. They just went down one after the other. Is that correct, Richard?
Yes, that's right. Yeah. It's just falls, the whole building, as fast as a bowling ball, yeah. As I mentioned. There is
And then after
you
that...
You can't do that with fire. Fire's never even brought down a skyscraper, ever, in the history of skyscrapers. Before 9/11, not one has come down due to very much hotter, larger, and longer-lasting fires in these buildings.
Can I butt in there? Yeah, there was an interesting article in the New Yorker, which is, of course, a mainstream publication, so they couldn't go into it in any further. But they asked a series of experts whether they thought the towers were going to collapse before they did. Nobody thought they were going to collapse. The architectural profession had a big debate as to whether those buildings were safe. The fire department, as I mentioned earlier, set up their headquarters in the buildings. Nobody thought those fires were going to cause the buildings to collapse until the collapse happened.
Right, I'm going to ask you all the same question, including you, Martin Summers. Why does it matter? You first, Dave Barmby.
Why does what matter? The fact that...
How the building collapsed, Building 7.
Well, if it collapsed due to fires... which is so far-fetched. If it did collapse due to fires and there was a natural event, the way it's explained is building WTC7, a material from the Twin Towers, that's WTC 1 and 2, was ejected across 400 feet, by the way, and came in through the windows and set the furniture alight. But if you look at the windows, as you see the fires, there's no sign of windows being broken.
No, but why does it matter how the building collapsed and what made it collapse? Surely all that really matters is that it did collapse.
You're going to the end story, really, here. What matters is if it was a natural result of the planes striking WTC 1 and 2, then the official story stands up. But if the official story doesn't stand up, then you have to ask the question, how can those buildings come down? And Richard has identified and has got a lot of stuff on the website showing that it was a controlled demolition. So if it's a controlled demolition, then who... That requires people to set up the charges and the wiring and the computer program and all the rest of it. And that's going to take at least weeks, maybe months ahead. So that's a pre-planned operation.
Martin Summers, why does it matter how Building 7 came down?
Well, I think it's very interesting that on the day Donald Trump was on the record, because of course he's an entrepreneur who builds these kind of buildings, saying there must have been bombs in the building. So that's on the record, one of the few sensible things Donald Trump's ever said. And the other point, of course, is that clearly this is an inside job by the US security forces, probably part of Gladio-style operations going back to the 1950s, 1960s, the bombing Bologna railway station. The Italian police are pretty much convinced that was carried out by NATO intelligence services, but of course many people are blissfully unaware of the history of NATO terrorism.
Now this is something we keep accusing others of, like Gaddafi, the idea that a government might be bombing its own people. What's the implications of that?
Well, it didn't just happen on 9/11. It's been going on before that. That's what I would bring to this discussion. There's actually overwhelming evidence for Italian police investigation. In Posimato, as the head of the Italian Supreme Court, he was investigating magistrate on many of the bombing attacks in Italy in that era, and the finger pointed very clearly towards NATO intelligence services, CIA, MI6, SISMI. So they've killed a lot of innocent people already before 9/11.
And in Posimato, went on to denounce 9/11. There's almost certainly a similar...
Okay, Ian, the question to you, why the focus on Building 7 and how it came down? Sure, this is just a technical matter, really.
Well, no, I mean, as we've heard, you cannot do a controlled demolition at 3 hours' notice. And, you know, that's the fact. So there had to be foreknowledge, and somebody put the explosives in the buildings. You know, do we think it was Al-Qaeda? Well, in that case, they had even more, you know, vastly more capabilities than we ever would have imagined.
Okay, Richard Gage, why are we right to focus on Building 7 and the way it came down, and if so, why?
Well, the reason we do in the United States is that it is an educational opportunity to awaken architects and engineers to the broader picture of the Twin Towers. The reason we start with Building 7 is because this is the third worst structural failure in modern history. And yet most architects and engineers throughout the world are completely unaware of it. The American Institute of Architects did not educate their own members, of which I'm one. The American Society of Civil Engineers did not. And so when we showed them this in our exhibition booth with all the evidence, in the conferences of architects and engineers all around the country, we showed them Building 7 coming down. And by the way, your listeners can watch this very quickly on YouTube by searching for Building 7 collapse. And what they'll see is what the architects look at this and they go, oh my God, anyone can recognize it's a controlled demolition. Then you show the few small scattered fires in this building that are said to have brought this building symmetrically down at freefall acceleration into its own footprint in the exact manner of a classic controlled demolition. Then their minds are open to looking more detailed at the evidence with regard to the Twin Towers.
Now, look, Richard, some people, maybe architects, will say, well, this Richard Gage is pretty much on his own. Tell us a little bit about architects and engineers. How many people have signed up and agree with you that this is something that really does need proper investigation and that don't agree with the official account?
Right. Well, if I told you that 3,000 architects and engineers told you that your house was in danger of collapse, would you listen to them? Yeah, we listen to them. Well, 3,000 architects and engineers are demanding a new investigation of the destruction of all three skyscrapers on 9/11 because they took the time to examine the evidence, and they're shocked by what they did not know about, by what they have not seen in the mainstream media, what they have not heard from their government or their associations, professional associations. And so then they start talking to other people and their representatives in government. And you know, that's why we have in the U.S. an act for draft legislation for the reinvestigation of the destruction of all three towers called the Bobby McElvain Act, because Bobby lost his life in the North Tower as he was entering the building, and he was blown apart, literally. And his father has been screaming from the rooftops, supporting the architects and engineers, along with other family members who are on, two dozen of them at least, on our petition calling for a new investigation, including one from here in London, Matt Campbell, who lost his brother.
Okay, so how is this going, Richard? Is there any likely to be a reinvestigation, an official one in the U.S.?
Oh, sure there will be. There's been slowly building support for this among the public, and the pressure is increasing now on governmental representatives. And we will get that investigation. It is not among the top priorities.
One of the places that is looking at it is the University of Alaska, Fairbanks, and they have something called World Trade Center 7 evaluation. But apparently that was due to report any time now. This is a university department having a good look at Building 7. What's happening with that?
Yes, this is a three-year, $300,000 finite element analysis study of the third worst structural failure in modern history. And we have contracted with one of the top forensic structural engineers in our country, Professor Leroy Halsey, the chairman of the Department of Civil Engineering there in Fairbanks. And they'll be coming out this summer with their draft report. And it is just like NIST did. You know, it took NIST 8 years to come out with their report. Well, we're doing it in three. We've got a head start. And this is the report that NIST was tasked by Congress to produce, but which they failed miserably, with a report that can only be termed a cover-up of the crime of the century.
Ian Henschel, what do you make of, you mentioned these legal challenges earlier on, what do you make of any serious progress towards officially, literally, getting people in front of judges, answering questions, and making some real change over, I mean, it's a bit like something like the Grenfell Tower fire. A lot of people want to see arrests, questions answered about councillors like Rock Fielding Mellon, who apparently, the Conservative from Kensington and Chelsea, who signed off this flammable cladding as the new kind of way of cutting costs on that tower. The similar thing with September the 11th. What people want to see is proper legal investigations and people having to ask questions who were responsible for what happened.
Well, I think what you know, I'm not that optimistic, to be honest, in the long run about the American courts. I think the United Nations is a much more likely forum to get the full truth about 9/11. But the great thing about the court cases is that it makes it very, very difficult for the mainstream media to pretend that there isn't any issues here. And sooner or later, it's going to crack. I mean, I know most people that I know don't like Trump much. I don't like him much either. But his hands are fairly clean on the 9/11 issue, which you couldn't say for Barack Obama or, of course, George W. Bush, who benefited so much by it, and by Barack Obama, who continued to cover it up and tried to obstruct justice as much as he could. Oh. So, yeah, you know, it's a huge step forward. And who knows, you know, so we might get some people speaking out of turn in the court hearings, and then it'll really go big.
Yes, hopefully. But look, one of the key things was explosions which were reported in the World Trade Center buildings, one and two, the big twin towers, before the planes even hit.
Before,
Ian. Can you tell us about that, and what evidence is there for that?
Well, the main, you know, the most high profile figure is a guy called William Rodriguez, and you can see a picture of him in the White House with Hillary Clinton, with George Bush at a White House reception. He was a very respected guy. He was described as a hero. He had immense knowledge about the building. He worked there as the chief building janitor, and he was in the basements, and he's got no doubt that there were massive explosions in the basements before the planes hit the buildings. And, you know, there are other reports corroborating that as well. You can look into the seismic issues, you can look into the plane flight issues, and it does look very much as if indeed nasty, huge, big explosives were going off in the basements of both World Trade Center 1 and 2.
Now, Richard Gage, is this something you've come across?
Yes, it's not just William Rodriguez. There are many, many witnesses of explosions in the basements. And whether they're before the plane or after the plane, there shouldn't be any explosions in the basement. We're talking about a 50-ton hydraulic press that is completely destroyed. We're talking about the parking structure damaged very, very badly. Many, many witnesses actually talk about explosions before the planes hit, which is, of course, direct evidence of pre-planning for this event as well. Some think that these particular explosions are intended to have sabotaged the firefighting effort by the automatic sprinkler system. Regardless, there should not be explosions in the basement. There should not be explosions in the lobby, which were not a caused by the jet fuel. And there shouldn't be explosions going off 20, 40, 60 stories down below the point of jet plane impact in each of these buildings, which the videos show plenty of. Why are those all happening? The firefighters, over 118 of them, describe in the oral histories that were recorded by Thomas von Essen in October all these explosions, seeing explosions, feeling explosions, I mean, experiencing them, being blown around the building by them, seeing flashes of light. We showed these on our presentation that we did at the Seven Dials Club the other night, and we had 150 people in the group that raised their hand at the end. All of them, not one of them, believed the official story after actually having looked at the evidence, and that's why it's so powerful. So I do encourage people for themselves to check out this evidence on YouTube. Our DVD is there. It's called Experts Speak Out, 9/11 experts speak out, and they can see 40 high-rise architects, structural engineers, metallurgists, chemists, physicists, controlled demolition experts, all laying out this evidence, which is absolutely irrefutable.
But hang on, Richard, because if planes hit a building, this doesn't happen every day, does it? Surely there's going to be repercussions within that building, explosions going off anyway.
The planes hit 1,000 feet or more up above the basement. There's no repercussions that would destroy a 50-ton press down below, or the lobbies, which were completely destroyed. The elevators had explosions. They were described by witnesses as the doors blowing out and open. Only two elevators come down from the point of jet plane impacts from the all the way continuously from the windows of the world up there. So there were pre-planned explosions in the basement and in the elevators, which apparently were designed to sabotage them. That's speculation, but what's not speculation is all the evidence of these explosions that were in fact picked up 20 miles away at the seismic station at Lamont Doherty Earth Observatory, which are evidence of explosions, according to geophysicist Andre Rousseau, who in 2012 developed a long peer-reviewed paper that that documents that these seismic signals were not the airplane hitting the tower. These are explosions, very powerful explosions.
Now, if 9/11 was some sort of criminal inside job, one of the first things that you would see is that the story would be changing. This is what always happens. Any copper will tell you with a criminal is that you've got to make sure that they actually stick to the same story. If the story starts to change, maybe the whole thing originally was a lie. Now, Ian Henshaw, can you give us any indications that the story has changed over the years?
Well, the story has changed spectacularly, actually, because originally the word unthinkable appeared in practically every politician's mouth in the West. Unthinkable. Well, it might have been to the public unthinkable, but it certainly wasn't to the establishment, because we know that Operation Bojinka was an Al-Qaeda plan that never came to fruition 4 or 5 years before 9/11 for blowing up airlines and flying them into buildings. That was they knew about that. Condoleezza Rice, who constantly went around saying she was the Secretary of State, who constantly went around saying how, you know, what a big surprise it was, nobody could be expected to predict this, blah, blah, blah. Rubbish. They had predicted it, or at least it was a known possibility. They said, and here's the really big one, they claimed that the alleged hijackers who flew the planes into the buildings, and that's, of course, another issue altogether, whether they did or not, but the alleged hijackers, they said, were completely unknown to them. And gradually over the years, and this, I think, is a really, really big issue, it's come out beyond any doubt, based on the testimony of multiple FBI officers, that actually these hijackers were quite well known to the CIA, and they were indeed protecting them from arrest. The FBI, several FBI officers have stated very clearly on the record that had it not been for the active obstruction by the CIA, not the passive obstruction, the active obstruction by the CIA, had it not been for that, 9/11 would never have happened. That's, of course, if you follow the official story about the hijackers, which is another question, because most people think they couldn't have flown the planes.
Yeah, they weren't that well trained, were they? Now, Richard, what about you? Let's hear from you about any... Was there any indication that the story, whether it be by NIST or anyone else from the government, the military, that it actually changed about what had happened?
Oh, yeah, NIST changed their story about Building 7, for instance, several times. They had 7 years that they delayed the final report coming out after architects and engineers who completely forgot about it. I mean, those who knew about it, which is a very small percentage. So at first NIST was saying, oh, the diesel fuel was because there were generators providing backup electricity for the 23rd floor of this building, which was a command bunker that Giuliani was intended to use for running the city in the event of a major catastrophe like this. But later it was confirmed by many associated with our group, particularly, that there's no diesel fuel burning in this building. The diesel generators were on the fifth floor with large louvers that were not even smoking. So we've got them to back off on that story, and then they had to focus on this incredibly warped sequence of events, starting with expanding beams pushing a girder off of its seat. But none of that could have really happened either, because these beams are fully fireproof. They can't heat enough to expand. What this did in their computer model is to apply all of the heat from these fires into beams in just a second and a half, forcing them in their computer model to expand to try to make this warped theory of theirs work. But it's fraudulent all the way, because they have to eliminate critical structural components from the connections, such as stiffeners, which would have kept the flange of the girder from folding once it got halfway off of its seat on column 79. They omitted shear studs on the top of the girder, which tied it to the concrete slab, which means it never could have slid sideways from the very beginning.
And so, Richard, sorry to interrupt you, but I mean, what you're saying sounds to me as if there may have been deliberate fabrication behind this. Is that really feasible?
Deliberate provocation?
Fabrication. I mean, these are supposed to be
absolutely
professionals.
Yes, this is fraud. It's complete fraud from beginning to end. They omit these stiffeners, and they do not provide the computer input data that gives them the results that they say proves their theory. And so we file a Freedom of Information Act, which we can do in the U.S. with any U.S. agency. And if it's not a matter of national defense, they have to release this information. But what do they write back with the only out that they had and say, oh, it might jeopardize public safety if we were to release this information. Well, wait a minute. It jeopardizes public safety, does it not, to withhold this information from the architects and engineers who are tasked with ensuring the public safety? This is absolutely a black box. This is not open investigation whatsoever. And every time we see into it, what we see is fraud, including this whole theory of the collapse vertically inside the building and the gutting of the interior of the building before the overall ever comes down. Had that happened, we would have seen massive deformation of the exterior structural steel section. It would have been crumpling like a beer can if the inside came down first, because it would pull in those perimeter columns. They're rigidly tied. There'd be massive breaking up of granite panels and windows. We don't see any of that. We see a perfectly straight down symmetrical collapse like the old hotels in Las Vegas.
Now, what you're saying is absolutely fascinating, but have you had a reasonably good reception in the mainstream media over in the US? Have there been documentaries which have had, you know, an official from NIST, etc., and you discussing all this so that the American public can make up their mind?
Well, NIST will not go on record. They're very shy about exposing themselves. But we did have a 45-minute presentation on C-SPAN, and guess what? On the Washington Journal program, of the thousands of videos and interviews they've done with political and other figures, it became our interview became the single most watched of all of the videos on the C-SPAN.org website. So that tells you something. You know, when people have a chance to see this, they pass it around with each other. But no, we have not been invited to speak to Fox News, CNN, MSNBC, etc.
I mean, the thing is, sometimes you've got to knock on their door. What's your experience of the big guys, you know, that like CNN, etc.?
Well, in 2013, as an example, we put up billboards all around New York and around the world, on top of taxis and right in front of the New York Times. A 50-foot-tall billboard is huge, 20-foot wide. And it said, "Did you know a third tower fell on 9/11? the evidence might surprise you. And there's some other provocative information specific to the New York Times, because they put out an article denying this alternative theory. So we've certainly tried. We've knocked on all their doors. We've delivered them the evidence directly, as we have the, all 535 members of Congress, giving them the 3,000 petition signers, the evidence in DVD form, and the Bobby McElveen Act text, which we're looking for one brave congressman to actually introduce as legislation to start the controversy.
So Richard, why is it? Why is it, do you think, that they don't seem to want to hear what you've got to say? Why is that?
Well, I could speculate about that. I think Ian would probably do a better job, but initially, I would say they have a lot to lose. I mean, 9/11 gave us a $4.5 trillion global war on terror, which continues to this day in what is known as the 9/11 wars. There's about four or five or six of them, depending on how you count them. There's about to be one or two more in Syria and Iran. And as Ian has indicated, this is a provocation. 9/11 in a series of false flag operations that have been going on since the beginning of governments manipulating their people into war in order to gain regional hegemony in some part of the world, Middle East in this case, and enrich the arms industry, the banking industry, and the media, all of whom work together. In fact, 90% of the mainstream media in the U.S. is owned by just six corporations, who are in turn owned and operated by these other sectors of the economy, which I mentioned.
Yeah, one of the things that I've noticed about this is that it reminds me a bit of the communist era in Eastern Europe. I'm old enough to remember that, when the party line came out and everybody had to just fit in with the party line. And that's sort of what happened with 9/11. By 12 o'clock that morning, the American media had decided that Al-Qaeda was behind this. No real investigations at all. And of course, it's odd that, you know, on the one time they were saying that they didn't have any foreknowledge of it, and then on, you know, they could find out within about an hour who'd actually allegedly done it. So, you know, you find this party line. I think that's what happened to NIST. I think NIST basically thought, well, we can't look at the possibility of a controlled demolition, or we'll all lose our jobs, or something terrible will happen. You know, NIST is under the direct control of the White House, by the way. It's not the same thing as the normal air accident investigative bodies, who are much more independent and who have caused a lot of embarrassment to the White House, actually, and were not given the job of looking into the 9/11 attacks. So, you know, people, it's also about how people find it hard to imagine. And what editors in the mainstream media are doing is they're looking to say things that their readers are going to like reading, because otherwise they won't buy it again. And so if they tell them truths that are just too unpleasant or worrying for people, you know, it's not good business, quite apart from the fact that they're going to get into trouble in their careers.
But we have all sorts of chokehold truths, don't we, about what foreign governments are up to, killing children, gassing them, all this sort of thing.
Oh, we're quite prepared to make allegations against everybody except us. And I mean, I just thought that anybody who sees themselves as a citizen of the world must have noticed that President Assad of Syria gets a very different treatment from President Bush of America when something goes wrong in their country.
Martin, what do you make of this whole reluctance of the mainstream press to really take this seriously, to sort of get balanced views with both sides, Richard and NIST, for example?
Well, I mean, I think it's already been said that the mainstream press is bought and paid for to a large extent, and I do a lot of work.
Well, the BBC is surely government-funded.
Well, yes, it's government-funded, but
government-controlled
as well. I mean, I do quite a lot of work with Russia Today, and the fact of that is that they're constantly accused of being, you know, enemy propaganda, whatever, and we live in a world of propaganda. And just on a more general point, if the three buildings, steel frame buildings, collapsed on 9/11, which is what the official story says, then we should be actually closing down all steel frame buildings all over the world, shouldn't we? If they catch fire, they collapse, apparently. But in fact, we didn't do that, did we? In actual fact, all these buildings, we've got some of them in Bristol, there's plenty all over the world, nobody has closed down a single building on the back of this, even though three steel frame buildings collapsed as a result of fire. It doesn't make any sense. And of course, the mainstream media is really shown up in all of this. But of course, they lie all the time. They've lied about chemical weapons attacks in Syria, they've lied about the Skripal case here in Britain, and I come back to the NATO's history of false flag terrorism going back to the 1940s, and there's actually masses of evidence for that. The Belgian police, the Italian police, there's been investigations in Switzerland, and they all point in the same direction. The bombings of Dublin and Monaghan in 1972, where the Irish police are pretty much convinced, the Barron report points to MI5 being behind those bombings which killed 27 people. This is the sort of thing they've always done, but people live in a bubble where this has been going on forever, but they live in a world where they go shopping every Saturday and watch the game, and that's what's going on for them. And, you know, people are dumbed down. We've got infotainment.
Humans are sort of pack animals. We've got the genetic tendency to believe what we're told by our leaders.
Generally speaking, as long as they've got a critical mass of people going along with the story, loads of people will go along with it, because not to go along with it is more effort than to go along with it.
I suppose there's also tremendous embarrassment involved in admitting that for whatever 10, 15, 18 years you've been getting it wrong.
That's right.
And you've been lied to.
Well, Mark Twain said that the real problem is not convincing people they've been lied to. It's not lying to them. But they won't admit that they've been fooled. What's it Bush said, you know, fool me once, fool me twice, we won't get fooled again, or whatever it was. But I mean, that is the psychology. And don't forget, this has been orchestrated by psychological warfare officers. The people behind all of this are military officers with psychological warfare training. And of course, they know this is how it works, which is why they've got away with it so successfully so far.
Whether or not that's the case, Richard Gage, maybe you could just wind up by giving us a few pointers as to really good resources where people can go and have a look at this for themselves.
Oh, yeah. There's lots of information out there. There are hundreds of websites all around the world for members of the 9/11 Truth community. I like ours because what we've done is assemble the most scientific forensic evidence out there, which is not boring to look at. Again, on YouTube, I would highly recommend people search 911 Experts Speak Out. That's the documentary that we made on the subject. Just on the subject of Building 7 alone, there's an excellent YouTube video called 9/11 Solving... What is it? 9/11 Solving the Mystery of Building 7. Actor Ed Asner narrates this group of engineers and architects, and in 15 minutes you can get a great sense of the evidence of this Building 7, and everybody should be looking at that anyway right now, because you got to see this building coming down and just imagine hearing some government agency trying to tell you that this is due to scattered office fires, which is what they were, small, few, and scattered. By the way, the BBC announced the collapse of this building 20 minutes before it ever happened. I'm not kidding you. They apologized for this grievous error, citing the confusing events of the day. They even give the reason: due to weakening when the structural towers went down, the Twin Towers, due to structural weakening. So it's absolutely incredible what they're trying to pull on us. I mean, you could see Building 7 standing right behind the BBC's Jane Stanley as she's announcing the collapse of this building, when no skyscrapers ever collapsed due to fire. And yet CNN also announced the collapse of this building actually at about 10 or 11 that morning, not to be outdone by the BBC. And that was also obviously a mistake. There's also construction workers walking away from Building 7, hearing an explosion over their shoulder, looking back at the building, and then looking straight into the CNN camera, and they say, "Watch out, that building's going to blow up. A flame and debris coming down." we're moving back because the building is going to come down. They all know it's going to come down. They've been told it's going to come down. They're waiting for it to come down. And this is completely unprecedented.
Richard, what about the owner of the World Trade Center, Larry Silverstein? Because I think he said something about this. He mentioned apparently they were going to pull the building, pull it. Now, is that really, can you pin that down as something which is definitely about controlled demolition or not?
Well, sure. He says, he's interviewed a year later on the PBS, America Rebuilds is the name of the program. And he says right there, I was talking to the fire commander, and there's been such terrible loss of life. Maybe the smartest thing to do is pull it. And so they gave the order to pull, and we watched the building come down.
So now, what does that mean to you?
It comes back. Oh, yeah, exactly. Well, I mean, what could he be referring to? He comes back later and says, oh, I meant pull the firemen out of the building. But guess what? The firemen were not in the building. They weren't fighting the fire. The FEMA and NIST both say there was no efforts to fight this fire. So they weren't pulled out of the building at noon. There was no fires that were actually actively seen until about noon. So he couldn't have been mentioning that. Pulling a building is a term in the controlled demolition industry to pull a building.
Now, the other thing is, of course, in the World Trade Center Building 1 and 2, there were firefighters who had reported that they'd almost put the fires out just before the buildings came down.
Oh, yeah. The fires were severely diminished at the time of the collapse, particularly in the South Tower, where there's a few lapping flames and indicated by the thick black smoke. We have very cool fires that are oxygen starved. So NIST, of course, blames the collapse of the Twin Towers on these raging fires at the time of the collapse. In fact, is really their theory, because these floor trusses that span 20 meters between the interior group of core columns and the exterior column, they sag. And when they sag, they say they pulled in these perimeter columns. But the physics of it is such that even if there were fires, sagging floor trusses cannot pull perimeter columns in. There's not enough lateral force whatsoever. So they force, in their computer model, all these columns to fail all the way around the building with a 5,000-pound load at each one of these 14-inch square steel tube columns that occur at 3 feet, 4 inches.
Okay, Richard, we're going to have to go to the news now. We're going to have to go to the news now, but thank you very much. I'll put links to the various websites you've mentioned there. I know you're going to be on the George Galloway show in an hour or so, so you maybe better go and get ready for that. And our show page is thisweek.org.uk. We'll be back after the news with Ian Henshaw, Dave Barnby, and Martin Summers here in the studio.
When I grew up as a boy, I lived in Midwest City, which is right outside of Oklahoma City. I went to Midwest City Monroney Junior High School, which had just been built. We were the first students in that school. Nobody locked their doors. I never knew a girl that got pregnant. Never, ever, not once. Never knew anybody who was divorced. Never knew anybody whose home was robbed. We lived in a different world than we live in today. Everybody earned a living. Everybody who wanted to work had a job. I don't care who it was.
Yes, the audacious attack on New York and Washington by Islamist terrorists. Or is it the big lie of the millennium? We're doing a special on the September 11th attacks today, and it's really, I suppose, an antidote to the royal wedding. ...9/11 attacks in danger of turning this 21st century into a century of perpetual war, normalising the policy of regime change, targeting a country's resources and government, then cooking up any old excuse to invade them. The relevance of 9/11 today. Well, NATO's Anglo-Zionist Empire has been sending special forces into Syria and Iran to train terrorists. They're violating international law. Where it's politically difficult, we just hire Blackwater, or whatever they and their friends are called these days, to do it deniably on contract. In the studio tonight, we have author of 9/11, A New Evidence, Ian Henshaw, and also Oxfordshire-based retired engineer, author of a new report on the collapse of Building 7, Dave Barmby. You're going to be hearing in a minute from stewardess Rebecca Roth, who was so incensed with the 9/11 lies, she did her own investigation, which she produced as a book called Methodical Illusion. And before Hollywood director and candidate for governor of Arizona, Aaron Russo, died of cancer 10 years ago, he spilt the beans on secret conversations between himself and banker Nick Rockefeller, who told him in the 1990s about elite plans for the world, including a 9/11 style event leading to the invasion of Afghanistan many years before it actually happened. Plus, finally, on the Israeli connection, the Jewish former head of the studies at US Army War College, Alan Sabrowski, who believes the Israeli mafia control many key US institutions, including the Congress. Our sister show Dialects, back on BCFM 93.2 at noon every Tuesday. You can catch it online now at dialectradio.co.uk. This week, Karen Passmore from Bristol Disability and Equality Forum, which is losing much of its funding under Mayor Marvin Rees, talks about the horrific survival of the fittest effects of universal credit and why it directly linked to the explosion in homelessness in Britain. Dialect on BCFM next Tuesday at noon, or download it from dialectradio.co.uk now. Before we go back to talk about 9/11, Martin Summers, we've had a horrific week over in Palestine, haven't we?
Indeed, and of course this is all related to the main topic of this programme about 9/11, because of course there is clear indications that Mossad had some hand in what went on. It's not just the Western Intelligence Services, CIA, MI6, etc. And the five dancing Israelis were seen dancing on top of a van when the first plane hit, and they were videoing it. They were then arrested later, 8 hours later, because somebody took the number of the van, and it turned out they were all Mossad agents, and they were held for some while, and then eventually released and sent back to the US to Israel after about 40 days or so. They went on TV in Israel and said, yes, we were Mossad agents, we were just documenting the event. But of course, it was they were filming the first plane hitting the first building.
Weren't there art students? Were they art students?
Well, the art students is another aspect of this. The DEA were investigating a huge ecstasy
That's
smuggling.
The drugs people.
The Drugs Enforcement Administration, a huge ecstasy of Israeli art students who were going around pretending to sell art, but in actual fact using this as a cover for infiltrating various sensitive military installations and so on and so forth. And I think the copper's hunch about this is that the Israelis, the Americans, and I think the British were all involved in 9/11.
Now, going back to this week, the figures are at least 58 dead on Monday, Palestinian protesters, and up to, I've seen various figures saying up to 5,000 injured and hospitalised. Now, many people from Palestine have now having to be shipped over to places like Egypt to receive medical attention.
Well, I think what you've got to recognise about all of this is Israel doesn't actually have any recognised borders. They themselves have said, we don't have any recognised borders. That is not an international...
Recognised by whom?
No, the Gaza Strip is not an international border. It's a ceasefire line from 1948, and when it was agreed that there was going to be a ceasefire, it was then agreed that people would be allowed to go back to their farms and houses. And of course, most of the people in Gaza used to live on the other side of the wire in the land that's been seized by the settlers who have settled it subsequently. But the Israelis are presenting this as a protection of their border. Of course, they're overwhelmingly force. There's no Israeli injuries at all, so they're not under any kind of threat from these protests. So they've just gunned these people down ruthlessly. But the fact is, that is not. not an international border. And that what's happening now is there is no two-state solution. The Americans have recognized Jerusalem as the capital. Therefore, it's back to war between Palestine and Israel. And of course, the Israelis have got no leg to stand on morally when that war comes. And eventually, you may see a push by the Syrian army, backed by the Iranians and the Russians, to retake the Golan Heights, which of course are not part of Israel.
Okay.
Even though they're full of oil.
The United Nations today, we've heard UN Human Rights Body calling for an international inquiry in Gaza, although I don't know quite why you need an inquiry about what's happened. It's all pretty obvious what's happened there. Gazans, apparently, according to the UN, are caged in a toxic slum from birth to death. The new UN Human Rights Chief says that. And Jerusalem blasts the anti-Israel council. And Turkey has been ripping into the United States for defending Israel and must be held accountable for the massacres of innocent people.
Well, in other words, we're going to a major Middle East war. And, of course, the Israelis will have to fight Hezbollah in Syria or possibly in Lebanon, where they've just won the election. But it's not clear that they can beat Hezbollah, because in 2006, Hezbollah thrashed the Israeli defence forces. And they're much better organised now than they were then.
So if
the Israelis go to war with Lebanon, they're going to lose.
Can you see why the Israelis might object to the UN using language like Gazans being caged in a toxic slum from birth to death?
There's no reason why they can't object, because that's the situation. There's a blockade on Gaza, so they can't get any food or anything in. It's been the military dictatorship in Egypt is backing up the Israeli position, and you've got a younger generation in Gaza who've literally got nothing to lose. And you remember the film Gandhi, where they marched towards the salt and they were being beaten down with lathes and so on? That's exactly what they're having. This is non-violent. The Gazans have decided to go for non-violent protest, and that means that they're prepared to die to bring this to a head. And it will be brought to a head, but ultimately it may well be settled not through non-violent protest, but a war between Israel, Hezbollah, Syria, Iran and Russia, and the Israelis are going to lose. Netanyahu was actually at
not if the Americans join on the Israelis.
Well, no, well, but the Americans might find out who did 9/11 between now and then, mightn't they?
Well, what, tomorrow?
Well, that's going to be part of the war. General Ivashov, who was the commander of the Russian armed forces on 9/11, have made it quite clear that the Russians always knew what happened on 9/11. And when it comes to a fight, then one of the first things they're going to do is drop all the things they've got on onto the, you know, everybody will be told what they know.
Okay, so let's get back to this week. And Mark Regev is the Israeli ambassador to the UK. He was on Channel 4 News, and here he is responding to Jon Snow's questions about why it's necessary to shoot soldiers, to be shooting people who are apparently unarmed, apart from maybe some with stones, and injuring up to 5,000 just this week.
We have civilian communities immediately adjacent to that border. We have farms, we have townships within half a kilometre, a few hundred metres from that border. It's our obligation to protect our civilians. And let's let the Hamas people speak for themselves. They said, the leader of Hamas said, the goal is to penetrate into Israel. He said to cut out the hearts, to cut out the hearts, to kill the Israeli civilian population. Obviously, we have to protect our people.
Yeah, well, that's the sort of sloganizing that you are very used to from Hamas.
We shouldn't take those threats seriously, John.
So perhaps we shouldn't take the UN seriously when they say an attempt to approach a crossing or crossing the fence does not represent a threat to life or serious injury. There are not sufficient grounds for the use of live ammunition.
We would say the following. If you are trying to cross into our country, destroy the security fence, and you've declared your goal is to kill Israeli civilians, I think that's a threat that we would be irresponsible not to take seriously.
It's not an international border, as I pointed out earlier, and in actual fact, the Israelis have got no right to say that this is a border and we're going to defend it in this way. And in any case, what's going to happen now, the Hamas have really come to the understanding that they can't actually fight there. They're not going to fight. They're going to carry on using non-violent tactics. But of course, Hezbollah, the Syrian army, the Russian army, that's another story.
So where is this heading, Martin Brief? That's finally on this news from this week. Where are we going?
What was interesting about this, Netanyahu invited himself to Moscow for the May the 9th victory parade. And I think what Putin is trying to do is he's trying to get the Israelis to back off on a war on Syria and Iran. And he's trying to get the Iranians and the Syrians to compromise with the Israelis to prevent a war. But of course, it looks like the Israelis are dead set on a war, in which case I hope that Hezbollah are going to bloody their nose.
Simple question, why?
Why? Because they've got an expansionist ideology. a bit like Serbia in the 1990s. And of course, we went to war with Serbia, which the Israelis didn't support, and killed thousands of their civilians to make them disgorge Kosovo. And of course, Sharon didn't support that because he understood the implications. Now, we've just put in no-fly zones over Libya, no-fly zones over Iraq. If the Israelis attempt to use air power against civilian population of Gaza, I would argue the RAF should shoot them down.
Okay, so much of what we're talking about tonight seems to be connected with the Middle East. Back to you, Ian Henshaw. You're the author of 9/11, The New Evidence. What about the Saudis? Because this is one of the things that does bother me. Now we've got an alliance with Saudi Arabia supplying with massive amounts of weaponry, and yet most of, apparently, even all of the hijackers apparently were Saudis.
Well, that's true. Not all of them, but I think 15 out of 19. But, when you start investigating and looking at the paper trail, the first place you get to is the Saudis, and the second place you get to is the CIA. Now, Israel, you know, I think the best model to understand this is not to think about the CIA. There's lots of different types of people in the CIA. We're only talking about a very small number from the CIA operations department. The Pakistanis, there's quite a lot of evidence to show that they had a hand in 9/11 as well. So what I think you're looking at is a sort of group of people taken from each of these agencies. Everybody, I think, had a look in, but only in their sort of very secret sort of parts of, so, you know, we can't say Pakistan helped create 9/11. We can't say Saudi Arabia did quite, although with Saudi Arabia, there is a lot of evidence that actually the government did support those alleged hijackers in the United States. One problem is that the 9/11 truth community is sort of split between the people who don't believe the hijacker story at all, in the same way as most, a lot of people don't believe the towers story. Nobody who's looked at it believes it. A lot of people say, well, you know, that you couldn't have flown the planes like that. We don't really believe the hijackers existed either. But the problem there is that they would have needed patsies. So even, and patsies are sort of people to blame who aren't really responsible. So the problem is that they did need these patsies, whether or not they flew the planes into the towers. And the evidence is that the pilots that they designated as being the pilots, that the FBI designated as being the pilots, they could not have flown those planes. They did not have the flying skills. And that's a matter of that's on record from the training companies whose job it is to train pilots. They had these guys in training and they were hopeless. They couldn't even fly small planes, let alone big planes. Another problem with the hijacker list is that they've got two captains, two genuine airline captains in one plane and none in another. So it looks as if somebody made a little bit of a mistake on faking the paperwork there.
Interesting. Well, that's certainly feasible. Anyway, one person that's had quite a good look at this and actually come out with a book called Methodical Illusion about it is the former stewardess, air stewardess, American, Rebecca Roth. So let's have a listen to her. And here she picks up on some of the stuff you were talking about there, Ian.
There's a passenger on flight 175. That's the second plane that left Boston's Logan. And he said, there are two things that passengers said. One of them said to his father, I think they're going to, well, first he said, they've stabbed an airline hostess. And that's something we've never been called in the United States. We've been stewardesses and then flight attendants since the late 60s. Airline hostess is what El Al uses, some Middle Eastern and some Asian and some European airlines will use airline hostess, but not here. And so I had to look to see, who is this guy? How old is he? Is he 85? Is he from Germany? Or is he from Israel? Or is he from Japan? Or what? Actually, he was just an American. He was only 32. Since the time he was maybe 5 or 6 years old, we in the air had been called flight attendants to him. In every news report, every magazine, every story he'd ever seen, or any flight he'd ever taken, we would be called, have been called almost his entire life, flight attendant. So I thought, well, what a weird combination of words for him to use. That's really weird. It's like someone told him to say that. And then I started to put down all the words that were used, and there was, all of the calls were very scripted. And so they needed to be, because if you look back right now, I know we're all embarrassed, that those of us that are waking up are kind of embarrassed that we were manipulated.
These are the calls from the aircraft to the ground.
And really we were. It was master manipulation. But if you look back now, remember those flags were everywhere. Flags came out of everywhere. And these guys on Flight 93, let's roll, heroes. All of their wives were given huge book contracts right away. They made a Hollywood movie out of Flight 93.
Yep.
And so what we were looking at was like a Super Bowl. And if we hadn't had the details that came in from those cell phone calls, we wouldn't have known they were Middle Eastern descent. And we wouldn't have known they had plastic box cutters and that's how they did it. And we wouldn't have known all of the things that we found out from those cell phone calls. And if it were really Al-Qaeda, they'd have taken that plane out of Dulles and got into that cockpit on takeoff, and they'd have crashed it into the Pentagon within 5 minutes. No one in their right mind would have pressured themselves up against NORAD, the U.S. Navy, the Strategic Air Command, and our system that was supposed to be in place and fly around for an hour or an hour and a half. They wouldn't. Nobody would do that. That's insanity.
And
we remember the golfer who had a medical condition and passed out, and he was flying. They scrambled jets in 6 minutes, and I've had jets scrambled on me before. They happen really quick. They are pretty close to your wingtip, and it's frightening as heck, I have to tell you. But anybody that had any knowledge at all of our defense system would have known that. So why would they take off from Dulles, which is right across the river from the Pentagon, and fly all the way almost to Cleveland or so, and then turn it around and come back and go into this 270-degree corkscrew turn that was impossible for a 757 to be flown at, and then just so happened to meet head-on with the Office of Naval Intelligence, where they were actually investigating Enron, World Crossing, Global Crossing, and the missing $2.3 trillion. Why would terrorists care that those investigations were going on?
Yeah, really.
How would they know? And if they knew about that, they sure as heck knew that NORAD would scramble jets, then they wouldn't be choosing to fly for an hour and a half before they crashed into their site. So I started just using really common sense. And I had no political agenda. I had no religious agenda. I had no agenda but the truth. And so when I started down here, I started digging through this rabbit hole, I like to say. I just went until I found the truth. And what I did was I used my common sense and my airline knowledge. And then I started to see that we were actually asked to believe that on Flight 11, on American Flight 11, the first plane out of Boston, coincidentally, actually had on board not a federal marshal, but an Israeli Defense Forces Special Operations Sayer at Met Call, a highly trained assassin, and he was also trained as an anti-hijacking specialist, and he was trained in hostage rescue. His friends said that he could kill anybody with a credit card and a pen. And yet, we are to believe that he was killed by a 5'6" Arab terrorist, 20-some years old, that plotted this hijacking, sitting right behind him in business class, along with another guy. And this guy, the Sayerat Metcal assassin, was actually fluent in English. He grew up in Denver, Colorado. He was fluent in Hebrew because he moved to Israel when he was 14, and he was fluent in Arabic. So he probably could hear those guys right behind him. And if anybody's sat on an airplane, you know that if people are sitting behind you and they're talking, you're hearing their conversation, unless you're wearing some good Bose headphones so you can't hear the jets or anything else, right? So here he was, sitting in 9B on Flight 11, trained assassin, trained anti-hijacking coordinator, and actually fluent in the language that the hijackers were speaking in the road directly behind him, and he allowed himself to be killed by a quarter-inch blade on a plastic box cutter.
Well, also, the other thing that's interesting about this is it wasn't possible to make mobile phone calls from aeroplanes in that era. You can do it now, but at that time, you couldn't. And, of course, they then tried to finesse that by saying, well, in actual fact, it wasn't a mobile phone, it must have been the in-flight phones, which, of course, you have to put a credit card into.
Well, something like 3,000 feet, you can make mobile phone calls, even though you're not supposed to.
Yeah, but they're at 30,000 feet.
Good point.
And, of course, the other thing is, how believable, even if you could make such phone calls, how believable is it that people would give a running commentary on a battle they're fighting with terrorists on the mobile phones while they're doing it? Would you do that?
Ian Henshaw, I wonder what you make of Rebecca's point about the planes flying so far around, miles away from their targets, literally halfway across the US and back again.
Well, you know, what would they say? I think it's always worth listening to what your opponents would say. They'll say, well, you know, maybe they took a while to pluck up the courage. Maybe they had to wait till the pilot's door had been opened. But she's right, basically. It is bizarre. And the other thing that's worth mentioning is that, because there was a lot of discussion straight after 9/11 about the failure to scramble planes to intercept the hijacked planes. And they gradually botched together an official story which says that the planes were accidentally, by coincidence, all on manoeuvres in Canada as part of an exercise, and that's why there weren't any planes around. Which doesn't sound very plausible to me. There were some planes around, and there was a particular airbase that was never even asked to put planes into the air until about 2 hours later.
What about her point there about whether there really were any Al-Qaeda hijackers?
Well, I think that's a very open question. I can't tell you what I think it's. They certainly weren't the hijackers who were named by the FBI. That's beyond any doubt, because Hanihan Jor, the alleged pilot of Flight 77, was considered unsafe in a small plane, and he's allegedly fed a new destination into the autopilot and successfully taken over the controls to fly at full speed at ground level into the Pentagon. Now, any pilot, if there are any pilots out there, could I just make an appeal through your good offices here, Tony? I would love to hear from a pilot whether or not it is possible to reprogram an autopilot so that a plane will totally U-turn and go back to where it started from, which is the official story for how they got the planes. Because, it's difficult to know how they even navigated
the
planes.
I think Rebecca's great. She comes from a very, very sort of down-to-earth point of view, comes across extremely well. But she does talk about something, a corkscrew turn there. Tell us about that. Is that the plane that went into the Pentagon?
It did a long turn, a long descending turn. I'm not an expert, but they do claim that it is feasible, the official story people. I don't know if it's feasible or not. But certainly the people in the Pentagon controllers who physically saw the plane with their eyes, they said they thought it looked like a military plane.
And what about this aspect of various big investigations going on, that suddenly the offices where those investigations happened were demolished by these aircraft?
Well, not only that, but of course World Trade Center 7, it's not just the Pentagon. World Trade Center 7 was carrying out had offices that were carrying out the investigations into the Enron collapse, which George Bush and Tony Blair were up to their eyeballs in that. So George Bush would have been very, very relieved when those documents were destroyed in World Trade Center 7.
Okay, let's hear a bit more from Rebecca now, where she talks about evidence, well, absolute concrete proof that the FBI were lying.
As Americans, we were traumatized, so we were going to believe anything that we were being brainwashed and led to believe that day. And we were so blown away and not really paying close attention. The FBI originally had four names on this list of 19 hijackers. One of them ended up being an FAA aviation safety expert, an employee of the FAA in Florida. And his last name was Bukhari, and his brother, they think that the FBI claimed was on the manifest. This is their saying. These are the guys who were on the manifest. These are our hijackers. Now, this information came out within 12 hours, probably, of the planes crashing. So he shows up at the FAA and says, wait, no, I wasn't a hijacker. I'm alive. I didn't get on the plane. I didn't buy a ticket. I didn't have a thing to do with it. And his brother, who they claim, the FBI now is claiming, they know who the hijackers are. And here's two of them. They're brothers. His brother had been dead in a small plane crash a year earlier. And so he said, my brother couldn't have been on it either because he's dead. And then the two other gentlemen, I forgot their last names now, showed up also at their local FBI and said, no, here's our alibi. This is what we do for a living, and we weren't a part of these airplanes. So they quickly changed the story. And the Bukhari brothers actually owned originally the Mohammed Atta rental car story with the Quran and the flight logs, or the flight bag and all of the will and testament. That whole entire story originally belonged to those two brothers. So they just switched out with Mohammed Atta with that. That's just crazy. And I don't think many people really know that. I didn't ever find that until I'd actually finished the book.
I mean, I think the shocking thing about a lot of this, Martin Summers, is that the details, if you actually start looking into them, just simply don't add up at all.
No, well, as I said, General Ivashov, who was the commander of the Russian armed forces on the day, and he's still around, he's retired now, he made pretty clear in stuff he said on the internet, we knew what was happening all along. We've always known. And, of course, that's going to be decisive in World War III.
Now, one of the other people that has commented quite a bit on the September the 11th attacks is he's dead now. He's a former producer and director in Hollywood. He also owned nightclubs. He stood to be the governor of the state of Arizona, I believe, and or maybe Nevada, not sure which, maybe, because actually Nevada's Las Vegas. That's quite a big state to be running. And as a result, he was approached by Nick Rockefeller, the banker, from the banking family. And here is Aaron Russo describing what Nick Rockefeller had to say to him, because apparently Rockefeller told him about the September 11th attacks before they ever happened.
I met Rockefeller through a female attorney I knew who called me up one day and said, one of the Rockefellers would like to meet you. I had made a video called Mad as Hell, and he'd seen the video and wanted to meet me and knew I was running for governor of Nevada. So sure, I'd love to meet him. And I met him and I liked him, and he was a very, very smart man, and we used to talk and share ideas and thoughts. And he's the one who told me 11 months before 9/11 ever happened that there was going to be an event. Never told me what the event was going to be, but there was going to be an event, and out of that event, we were going to invade Afghanistan to run pipelines from the Caspian Sea. We were going to invade Iraq, you know, to take over the oil fields, establish a base in the Middle East, and make it all part of the New World Order. And we'd go after Chavez in Venezuela. And sure enough, later, 9/11 happened. And I remember he was telling me how how you're going to see soldiers looking in caves for people in Afghanistan and Pakistan and all these places. And there's going to be this war on terror, which is no real enemy. And the whole thing is a giant hoax, you know, but it's a way for the government to take over the American people.
He told you it was going to be a hoax.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. There's no question. He says, there's going to be war on terror. And he's just laughing. There's no... Who are we fighting? I mean, why do you think 9/11 happened and then nothing's happened since then? Do you think that our security is so great here that these people who pulled off 9/11 who were able to can't knock down another plane? Come on, it's ridiculous. 9/11 was done by people in our own government and our own banking system to perpetuate the fear of the American people into subordinating themselves to anything the government wants them to do. That's what it's about, and to create this war, this endless war on terror. And that's why and that was the first lie. And the next lie was going into Iraq, you know, to get Saddam Hussein out with his weapons of mass destruction. That was the next lie. So it goes on and on forever. And they can do whatever they want. They scare the hell out of the American public. Look, this whole war on terror is a fraud. It's a farce. It's very difficult to say it out loud because people are intimidated against saying it. Because if you say it, they want to make you into a nutcase. But the truth has to come out. That's why I'm doing this interview. The fact of the matter happens to be that the whole war on terror is a fraud. It's a farce. Yeah, there's a war going on in Iraq because we invaded Iraq. And people over there fighting, you know. But the war on terror, it's a joke, you know. And until we discover what really happened on 9/11 and who was responsible for 9/11, because that's where the war on terror emanates from. That's where it comes from. It was 9/11 that allowed this war on terror to begin. And until we get to the bottom root of 9/11, the truth of 9/11, will never know about the war on terror.
Now, Martin, Aaron Russo there is talking about this war on terror being a farce, a fraud. He's talking about, he's saying that he's got this from someone called Nick Rockefeller. Is he credible?
Well, I mean, I'm inclined to believe what's said. Going back to what I was saying earlier, there's actually a track record of NATO intelligence services engaging in false flag terrorism, particularly in Italy during what they call the Strategia di Tensione, the strategy of tension, which began in the 1940s to prevent the Italian Communist Party from getting any share of power in Italy. We got into high gear at Piazza Fontana in 1969 when 9 people were killed in the Banco Agricola in Milan, and of course subsequent police investigations showed that far from being anarchists who were given the blame at the time, it was in fact the intelligence services who planted the bomb.
9/11 is one whole big step up from that.
It is, but the point is it's the same. What is the moral difference between killing 86 people at Bologna in a bomb which was planted by the NATO intelligence services, or killing 3,000 plus in the Twin Towers?
You could also almost say those were sort of practice operations, but there is another practice operation, and that is called Operation Northwoods, isn't it?
Well, Northwoods was exposed by Freedom of Information requests in James Bamford's book about the NSA, and anybody can look it up. I mean, the top brass of the US military, led by Lyman Lemnitzer, basically put together a plan to they were going to bomb airliners, that they would be fake, they would be blamed on the Cubans, and then they would invade Cuba. And I just saw earlier on the news feed here that a Cuban airlines plane has just crashed at Havana Airport. A Boeing 757 has just crashed at Havana Airport as we've been on air. Now, of course, if I was the Cuban intelligence services, I would be asking questions about why is our airplane blowing up? Because, of course, the 1964 Northwoods was exactly about that. And it went to McNamara, who was, Kennedy's fixer, and he said, well, this is bonkers, we're not doing this. And they threw it back in their faces. But all the top brass in the US signed off on it, that they would kill their own people, blame the Cubans, and then invade Cuba. That's how they were thinking in 1964.
From what Aaron Russo's saying there, Ian Henshaw, he's really painting a kind of Orwellian picture, saying that this is potentially this war on terror will last forever.
Well, they would. I mean, that was Cheney, you know, the vice president at the time. He said, you know, beyond our lifetimes. And that's right, of course. You can't ever win a war on terror, so there's never going to be an end point. That's one of the huge benefits of it for the arms industry. But I think another thing it might be worth taking into context here is something that people have pretty much totally forgotten about, the Oklahoma bombing, mm-hmm. which happened in 1995. And it was at a time when with hindsight, they were getting ready for the war on terror. And everybody in Washington was bemoaning the fact that nobody was worried enough about terrorism. Then the Oklahoma bombing happened. And it was blamed on Islamic terrorists. And they actually arrested the ringleader in London. The Brits are always very cooperative with these things. Well, of course, we now know, or we think we know, that it was Timothy McVeigh, an ex-American Special Services guy, and they soon dropped the Islamic terrorist side. Timothy McVeigh was caught by accident by some local FBI people. So I don't think it's completely wild to speculate that Oklahoma was a false flag that went wrong, and they learnt from that. One, get the official story out right away. So that's why you need the Patsy hijackers, so as you can explain why you're blaming Al-Qaeda. Oh, because there's some Al-Qaeda people on the plane. And that's, you know, that's the official story. And B, do it big. Even Oklahoma wasn't that big. Oklahoma's not that near anywhere. New York, you know, they did it big. Nationals from dozens and dozens of countries died in that, so all those countries could be involved very easily in the planned war on terror. And I think that's the thing, is do it big and people will be more intimidated, more shocked, more likely to swallow the story than if you actually do it small.
Okay, is it true, let's get back to some of the details of 9/11, is it true that none of the aircraft were intercepted on 9/11?
Correct.
None,
no.
Extraordinary.
There was a lot of speculation about that at the time. But the interesting thing to me is that Donald Rumsfeld, the then Defence Secretary, changed the rules about 3 months before 9/11. And you won't hear this very often. A lot of people in the 9/11 Truth Movement don't seem to be aware of this. He changed the rules in two ways. One, enforcement people on planes, I think they were called air marshals, were stopped from carrying live ammunition. So that's very useful if you're running the 9/11 attacks. It means that none of these alleged hijackers are going to get shot dead by an air marshal. And the second way they changed the rules was that the Secretary of Defense had to give permission for a hijacked plane to be shot down. That's particularly weird because the Secretary of Defense is not actually in the chain of command. And so when it came to examining the details of what went on in the chain of command, what you found was that all the messages went into a black hole in the Pentagon, which is due to the fact that nobody could find Rumsfeld. Rumsfeld had put himself in charge of coping with a hijack, and when the hijacks happened, he wasn't anywhere to be found to give his approval to anything. So, you know,
so
I think that's really suspicious.
Where was he?
He was going out giving first aid. He walked out. He ignored the first message that he received in a meeting. His aide has said that. After about 15, 20 minutes, he went out the back to be photographed by the media, so-called helping deal with the casualties, which looked great. You know, Rumsfeld with his sleeves rolled up, helping with the casualties. If you didn't know that he was supposed to be in the situations room giving the orders to intercept the planes and, if necessary, shoot them down.
Amazing. Also, some of the mainstream media have come up with something recently called the Looming Tower.
Yes, that's
what
very
is
interesting.
That?
Well, it's the story of how the CIA blocked the FBI from foiling the 9/11 attacks.
Hang on. So is this a drama about the conspiracy, the cover-up?
Yeah, it's described as a docudrama, and these FBI guys are very pissed off, excuse my language, are very angry about this. They've been talking about it ever since pretty much the day after 9/11. It's not just one or two of them.
Because there was actually a kind of rupture in the FBI at the time of 9/11,
absolutely,
wasn't there, with the deputy director actually being killed in the attacks and being sacked just before.
Well, the guy who would have been in charge from the FBI side had been driven out of the FBI in the months preceding, and he'd just been given a job. His name's John O'Neill. He'd just been given a job as head of security at the World Trade Center.
When you say he was driven out, why? How?
Well, it's complicated, but basically he was accused of disciplinary improprieties, and they made his life so miserable that he decided to resign.
Is this the guy who was actually trying to pursue some of the people who would eventually carry out the 9/11 attacks?
He went down to Yemen to... there was an American ship was sunk by, apparently, by Al-Qaeda, badly damaged in an attack in Yemen.
Yes,
and John O'Neill went down there as head of an FBI delegation, and the CIA absolutely hated him. And then later, when 9/11 came up, it turns out that one of the bosses of the FBI is actually a CIA guy on secondment from the FBI. It gets complicated. The basic message is that the FBI, if you believe the official story of 9/11, then the FBI could have stopped the 9/11 attack.
So this
and they
is,
were obstructed by the CIA,
so
very
this
actively
is,
obstructed.
This is good officials being thwarted by criminal officials within the structure.
Yeah, that's right.
O'Neill wrote a book, or was interviewed for a book, by Brissard and Dasky, who were French former intelligence agents. And he said at the time that he was after Bin Laden, but he was constantly prevented from carrying through his investigations.
Yeah.
There are quite a lot of films, internet films, not been shown on the BBC about this, and I came across one which I was quite impressed with, and it is, although the title I wouldn't necessarily agree is accurate, it's certainly got lots of interesting facts in it. The film is called 9/11 Conspiracy Solved, the names, the connections and the details. So let's have a little listen to a clip from that now.
On September 10th, 2001, Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld announced that $2.3 trillion in unadjusted funds were missing from the Pentagon budget. The very next day, the offices whose responsibility it was for tracking that money down were destroyed when American Airlines Flight 77 impacted that very section of the building. The only off-site backup for the Pentagon's black budget financial records was a secure federal office building in the World Trade Center complex. Strangely, it too was destroyed on 9/11. World Trade Center 7 was the largest CIA headquarters outside of Langley, Virginia, and housed offices involved in several large-scale federal investigations into massive stock market and accounting fraud. Not surprisingly, World Trade Center 7 was the first to be cleaned up and the evidence destroyed at Ground Zero.
Well, that's interesting. I didn't know that it was the first to be cleaned up. But, of course, access to Ground Zero was very, very limited. And we now know that the dust at Ground Zero contained millions and billions of circular iron spheres, tiny circular iron spheres, which can only come from vaporized iron. And, you know, that's one of the big issues that we didn't touch in earlier when we were talking about the collapse of the Twin Towers.
Well, please do now,
yeah. Yeah, well, you know, where can it come from? This is in that American National Geographical Survey that found this. It's undeniable. In the business, they talk about World Trade Center dust as a unique phenomenon, but they, for some reason, don't want to ask about how those spheroids could have got formed. The original FEMA investigation also found evidence of molten steel, which once again should not have happened. It would only happen if there were explosives or incendiaries of some sort. It wouldn't come from an office fire.
Okay, so what about these? What's been going on to cause these amazing World Trade Center iron spheres? What's that?
Well, it's got to have been something very, very hot. You wouldn't get that from jet fuel. I mean, we'd be speculating. Some people have speculated that it could be thermite, which is an incredibly effective high temperature incendiary. It's not an explosive, technically, I believe.
I always remember actually watching the black and white version years ago of The Man from U.N.C.L.E. The very first episode, there's a thermite explosion in it, which is used to. This was, I suppose, stuff that the military were playing around with in the 1960s, and new types of explosives. Martin, what is thermite, and how's it involved with all of this, do you think?
Well, I'm not an expert in these matters.
Dave, what about you? Have you got any thoughts? No, okay.
But I mean, there are others who are experts.
I understand that urine's very hot.
Well, I mean, you've got to Niels Harritz, who's a retired chemistry professor from Copenhagen University, and Steve... What's his name?
Steve Jones,
and they've got peer-reviewed academic papers which found nanothermite in the dust from the World Trade Center, and that's indisputable. Now, what the implications of that are, people can make their own conclusions. But these are two respected people, and they've done everything proper in the scientific world to get this stuff out there, and it's been peer reviewed, and there's no doubt about it. Nanothermite was found in the dust, which implies that nanothermite was the explosive. Which, of course, the only people who've got that are the U.S. military. Nobody else has got it.
Well, we've only got 10 minutes or so left now, so let's go to have a look, I suppose, at some of the speculation around and evidence around who did it. And one of the people who's had some fascinating stuff to say about that is a former head of the... I think it was... Director of Studies, that's right, at the U.S. Army War College, Alan Sobroski, who is from a Jewish family himself. So, in a way, it's probably better to have him talking about these matters than someone who isn't Jewish. But anyway, here he's talking about the influence of various people, including dual U.S. Israeli citizens, on the official bodies that were supposed to be investigating the 9/11 attacks.
When I was in Washington at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, one of our visitors for a luncheon talk was a young gentleman then named Francois Heisberg. Heisberg was the special assistant to French President Francois Mitterrand. And I don't know how this subject came up, but he said, you know, Americans never see conspiracies anywhere. We French, he said, we see conspiracies everywhere. And both of us are wrong. This is not a conspiracy in the sense that it is usually used, the word is usually used, which is to denigrate an opposing argument. When someone in the United States says that that's a conspiracy or that's a conspiracy theory, by definition they mean it is irrational, illegitimate, and without proof. All I would suggest to people is that you look at the films of WTC-7, that third tower going down on September 11th. You look and listen to the reports on September 11th with the secondary explosions. These are not fantasies. They happened. You look at the reports on September 12th of the apprehension of Israelis with bands of explosives and cameras filming the events on September 11. These are not fantasies. And you look at the people riddling the American government, all of the Middle East people in State Defense and the National Security Council, Deputy Secretary of Defense Paul Wolfowitz, Undersecretary of Defense for Policy Douglas Feith, who used to be a friend of mine, by the way, from Philadelphia. These people were all part of the neoconservative movement. Many of these people are dual U.S. Israeli nationals. All of their primary allegiance is to Israel. I don't much care about other people or other countries. I don't hate anyone in particular. I don't like anyone in particular. I'm an American. My loyalty is strictly to the United States. And I don't care what my ethnicity is or what my ancestry is. My allegiance is that. And my concern is only whether something helps or hurts the United States. And I think anyone who's a citizen of any country can very properly have similar feelings toward their country. What I'm concerned about is what is done to hurt America. And it is very clear that over a period of the last 40-odd years, that the penetration of the American political process, the effective subordination of the Congress in particular to Israel, when an Israeli prime minister can get 29 standing ovations from a Congress that can't give that much support to one of their own presidents, no matter how outlandish the statements, you have something as close to a puppet agency as you're going to find. Our policy in the Middle East has for decades been manipulated increasingly in terms of what benefits Israel and not what benefits the United States. Even when that policy is articulated and supported by individuals who are sworn officials of the United States government. And to me, when a sworn official of the United States government, whether or not that person has dual Israeli citizenship, manipulates American policy, contrives crises and tragedies like 9/11, contrives wars like Afghanistan and Iraq, and now tries to get us into a war with Iran, all in the service of Israel, spending American lives in that process, they commit high treason. And they need to be treated in that manner.
Well, I think that's very telling. I remember when I first came across his views some years ago, because, as he says, he's a Jewish ethnicity, but he doesn't make much deal out of that. But it's basically, it is treason. And ultimately, of course, as World War III develops, the fact that the people in charge in the US are traitors is going to be decisive, because they're going to be stabbed in the back even as they go forward.
But surely all
this is
why
they're going to lose.
All this talk about World War III is just scaremongering.
No, we're already in it. We started on 9/11, and of course people have been dying in Syria over the last 7 years, where the British, we've got evidence that the British orchestrated the uprising in Syria working with the Americans, so we're responsible for all those deaths. And ultimately, of course, the 7/7 attacks here in this country, Netanyahu got a warning, so he didn't turn up to a meeting that morning because somebody told him that there was going to be a bomb attack in London, which means that possibly Mossad had a hand in that, okay. In which case they killed 50 British people on that occasion. And I would suggest that it's about time Britain went to war with Israel, not for Israel. And, of course, that's how it's going to play out when it comes down to it.
Ian Henshaw, what about your thoughts about what 9/11 means for us today?
What it means for us today? I come back to an old-fashioned word, imperialism, actually. I think America was getting isolationist, which is a very bad word in the lexicon of the elite, especially here in Britain, Europe and Israel and the Middle East, because they want American involvement. They want American weapons to so-called protect them. So I think, you know, the Brits are actually, you know, as another of the groups who did have a hand in it. I'd say a very small part of the Brits, just like perhaps a fairly small part of the Israelis.
Well, we had the BBC. We heard about them, didn't we? knowing about World Trade Center Building 7 collapsing.
That was just a cock-up. I don't think they were, that woman was participating in it particularly. But the BBC
But the thing is that they haven't held their hands up. This is the problem, yeah. Isn't it? Afterwards.
Yeah, they won't admit anything. Can I just mention one thing? I was invited to give a talk talk at the Oxford Union, which is probably one of the most famous and high-profile debating societies in the world. Very American. There's lots of American students at Oxford. Lots of potential and future CIA people go to. And the American embassy was told, we're getting Ian Henshaw, who's a 9/11 skeptic, is giving a talk to the whole... There were hundreds of people came to this talk, almost 1,000 people. And the American embassy was invited to send somebody to debate against me. I'm not the blooming smartest person in the world by any means, you know. They wouldn't send anybody. They wouldn't even go to the Oxford Union to defend the story of 9/11. And I think that's just amazing.
Well, I mean, I did a 9/11 program years ago on Commonwealth FM before this radio station ever started. And all the American embassy would do was send a written statement. They wouldn't send anybody. We wouldn't give anybody on the phone or anything like that. Anyway, what's the state of the 9/11 truth movement today? Because I know you've had this meeting in London this week, for example.
Well, it was a big successful meeting. I think to some extent, to be perfectly honest, we were preaching to the choir, you know, to the converted. But on the train back, I got into conversation with the train guard, so that's pretty random. And he said that in his opinion, it was completely obvious that World Trade Center was brought down by explosives, and he thought everybody knew that. So I think the people who are the most difficult to persuade are the people who believe everything they read in The Guardian or Channel 4 News or the BBC. You know, and these are the people who have been telling these massively obvious lies lately about the chemical attacks in the alleged chemical attacks in Syria and the alleged nerve agent attack in Britain. And you can say they're lying because they're not looking at obvious flaws in their argument. You know, the Guardian had 3 pages on a plane shoot down in Ukraine a couple of years back without ever discussing what possible motive the Russians would have had to shoot that plane down. So, you know, people who won't operate fairly and give any airing to different opinions, especially when they're so well supported by facts, have got to be seen as essentially dishonest.
Martin Summers, this often does come down to the mainstream media, doesn't it? And I've heard just today that Ofcom may be taking this show off the air at some point in the future, that there's some sort of process that they're going through to see if that may happen. It all comes down to the mainstream media, doesn't it? And there's very few programmes like ours out there.
Well, indeed, and of course, I do work with Russia Today, as you know, and there's been suggestions that they should be taken down. But of course, the reason they're saying that is because they can't answer the sort of things that we say. And of course, if they do that, then BBC won't be allowed to operate in Russia. Of course, BBC Russia were the ones who did interviews on the ground when MH17 was shot down, with locals saying, well, we saw a plane from Kiev shoot it down.
Well, it might be a little bit
That went up on the BBC website in Moscow, and then the BBC in London shut them up.
It might be a little bit cheeky, but I'm just going to ask any of our listeners that appreciate what we do here, please write to Ofcom and say something about it, because we don't want to be taken off the air. Thank you very much, because we're one of the only people, I think, you're getting both sides. I mean, I try and put the opposite point of view to you guys, and also we're hearing from people like the Israeli ambassador too. So, I mean, what I like to see is balance, and I don't see a lot of that in the mainstream press. Anyway, Ian Henshaw, Dave Barnby, Martin Summers, and also we heard from Richard Gator. Thanks very much for joining us. We'll be with you next week. In the meantime, I'll leave you with something from 1966.
for you.
Whoa!
Is it any wonder I feel that my whole life is through?
Yeah!
When I start feeling how strong my love is for you. Wanting your love like I do. It's no secret at all when you got me jumping up and down. It's no secret, 'cause my heart is chained and bound. I love you, yes I love you, yeah. It's no secret.
Is Bristol's BCFM on 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.